Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Scientists estimate that the universe, with all its planets, stars, and galaxies, is roughly 93 billion light years in diameter. So it's easy to feel small on the relatively little blue ball of Earth. But our home is as much the universe at large as it is the Earth, according to Ohio State astrophysicist Paul Sutter. He wrote his new book, Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big Messy Existence, to explain that point of view. Paul Sutter also is chief scientist at COSI, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Welcome back to talk about your first book.
I know. How exciting and scary is this?
You've been writing this probably in your head for a long time, though, because it's kind of trying to explain to everybody else how the universe works and why we should care about it.
Yeah, and actually, as I went through college and graduate school, becoming an astrophysicist and a cosmologist, which is someone who studies the whole entire universe, the stories I tell in the book are the stories that we learn as scientists of how we know the things we know now. Here are the current problems. Here are your ancestors that have worked on these problems and the solutions they came up with. So it's almost like it's scientist bedtime stories that I learned growing up in, you know, in my 20s and 30s, but now I want to share with other people.
Today, NASA's InSight spacecraft will complete its seven-month journey to Mars. It will have cruised more than 301 million miles at a top speed of 6,200 miles per hour to get there. And when it lands, it will start studying the planet's interior, that is the inside of the planet. Mm-hmm. That's all most people can wrap their brains around when it comes to space exploration, is these kind of incremental pieces. We could get the moon. We can get Mars. Why do we everyday people need to consider our place in this vast universe, or the vast universe in our relationship to
it? The very first thing I tell people all the time is that astrophysics, aka my job, has absolutely no value to your everyday life. It really doesn't. And I'm not going to be ashamed of that, and I'm not going to apologize for it. It's just some scientists are trying to make the world a better place, and more power to them. Some scientists are just trying to figure out how the whole thing works, and more power to them too. It's a part of our natural curiosity. We're all curious. We all wonder. We all ask questions. All of us have occasionally looked up at the night sky and started wondering some really big stuff, like, what does it all mean? Are we alone? What's our place? These are common questions that humanity has been trying to answer ever since there's been a humanity. This is a part of us. And over the past 400 years, the amazing thing is we've been able to tackle some of these problems with the scientific method, with the scientific approach. And we've been able to get some answers. Probably not the answers we were expecting, but some answers that have led us to some completely unexpected and surprising directions. And so the stories I tell in the book, the themes I explore in the book, the history of the universe itself, the history of our knowledge of cosmology of the universe, it's these kinds of basic fundamental questions that we're always asking. And here are some answers.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about our place in the universe. My guest is astrophysicist at Ohio State and chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. His new book is titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big Messy Existence. If you have a question or comment for Paul, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why the messy reference?
One of the most surprising things we've learned in astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology is we used to think that the heavens, the celestial realm, the stars and planets and all that were totally separate and different from the Earth. That our lives here on the Earth were complicated and unpredictable and messy and it just, a nightmare. But then you look to the sky and you see how regular the patterns are. The same constellations, the same stars, the same sun, the same, everything's regular and perfect. But then we started making deeper observations. And we notice that the planets aren't exactly perfect, that the sun has spots, that Venus has phases, that the moon is made of jumbled rocks. And we start making deeper observations. We start to learn that stars come in different colors and different sizes and different distances. They move, they're born, they die in explosive deaths, that there are these big giant nebula that are somehow connected to the lives of stars. And then we discover galaxies, and the galaxies themselves are moving around and have lives. And then we discover that the entire universe itself is changing with time. It's been a story of change on greater and greater scales, and how the universe itself is just as messy, just as unpredictable, just as chaotic as our lives here on the Earth. We're not so different from the universe after all.
The book covers a lot of ground. What parts did you feel like you had to cover in order to, and a lot of ground, of course, is a metaphor for the universe.
The universe is rather large.
It's not all ground. What parts did you feel like you had to cover in order to make sense of what you wanted to cover? Was that a challenge?
That's a really good question, because I think every story, every chapter, either in the history of our universe going back 13.8 billion years, or the history of our understanding of physical cosmology going back 400 years, it was actually more about what do I have to leave out, because there's so many stories to tell. There are so many interesting scientists with their individual passions and interests solving some small problem that decades later ends up revolutionizing the field. And there's so much fascinating physics that we're barely able to understand going back 13.8 billion years. So it was more about, if I want to present our current state of knowledge and our current state of what we don't understand, the current mysteries that we're trying to tackle right now, what's the bare minimum of backstory do I need to give the readers to get to that current present day mystery? And I actually had to sit down. I remember writing down all the potential topics, and it was like 50 chapters. And obviously that wasn't going to work. Now, I'm not going for a multi-volume edition here. So I had to pare it down to the bare bones of making sure that every story I told led into the next chapter, weaved into our understanding of the universe in some way, so that you could come out of the book understanding the history of our universe, the history of understanding, and where we are now. So if you see a news article about dark matter or dark energy or the expansion of the universe or how stars form, you have some idea of the history of how we got to that current problem.
And you start the book out by making the distinctions of how between 400, 500 years ago, how the scientists of the day, mm-hmm. such as they were, philosophers and the questioners of the day viewed it, the lens through which they viewed all of this. And now, and a lot of that has to do with the whole faith issue and religion and that sort of thing. And there were they were the heretics of their day in their own way.
They were the heretics, and they were also some of the most faithful, fervent religious people you could ever meet. It's absolutely fascinating to take away our filters of the past, where we have our present day mindset, where scientists do sciencey things, philosophers do philosophy things, and religious people do theological things. And they all kind of stay in their separate lanes, and they have their own separate conversations. And that seems to work. You know, there's a reason that system developed. We all get to play along nicely as long as we stay in our lanes. But we have a tendency to look back, especially at the birth of science, the birth of modern science, going back 400 years, the Copernican Revolution, the ideas that maybe the Earth isn't the center of the universe. And we tend to put our current present day filters on that view, where it's not exactly appropriate. Where if you look back at people like Copernicus or Kepler or even Galileo, they were just as religious, just as philosophical as they were scientific, and they were motivated by things that would not motivate a present-day scientist. My favorite example in the chapter I start off with is the story of Kepler. Kepler discovered that the planets move not in circles, but in ellipses, which doesn't seem like that big of a deal, but at the time was tremendously a big deal. And he was motivated by numerology, of all things. He was motivated by astrology, by being able to provide better horoscopes for his patrons than just trying to understand how the universe works. He was searching more, and this is buried, I almost said buried in his writings, but it's not buried. It's like the very first line. He's searching for the voice of God in the motions of the heavens and how he can use that to predict our daily fortunes. To us, that sounds nutballs, but to him and his contemporaries, totally legit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about having that honest approach, I think, is important.
You wrote that the more accomplished we become and the smarter we get about the universe, the more we learn how insignificant we are. And that's troubling. I mean, we can become disinterested because of that.
Oh, yeah. It's very easy. It's very easy to read this book and have a total existential crisis. And part of the book is the story of how over hundreds of years, our view of the cosmos progressively got bigger and bigger and bigger. Where 400 years ago, it was like, no way could the stars be that far away. That's ridiculous. And then 200 years ago, it's like, what's that fuzzy patch? Is that, you know, how far away could that fuzzy patch be? Oh, the fuzzy patch turns out to be a whole entire galaxy that's millions of light years away. And it's these continuous stories of, nope, the universe is way bigger than you thought it was even possible.
But we still don't know exactly how big, or they've made estimations?
We know that our observable universe, the limit of what we can see, is about 90 billion light years across. There is more universe past that limit, but we just can't see it because light can only travel so fast and the universe has only been around for so long. So that part, light from that part of the universe simply hasn't reached us yet. How big the whole shebang is, that's an open question. Maybe it's infinite, maybe it's just significantly large, but we don't know.
We are talking about the universe today. My guest is Paul Sutter. He's an astrophysicist at Ohio State, chief scientist at COSI, and author of a new book. It's titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big Messy Existence. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the universe as our home. Still with us, OSU astrophysicist and chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. His new book is titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big Messy Existence. If you have any questions, please give me a hand here. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can also check out our Facebook page, the All Sides Facebook page as well. Don't message us. Just post it right on the Facebook page. Paul Sutter, thanks again for joining us. I wondered if you could put the size of the universe in terms of football fields. You know, that's kind of how people think of things. And, you know, when you're trying to explain, it's really, really big. Is it infinite? We don't know. That's pretty big. You're even saying
large.
We don't know.
Yeah.
It's very large. But why does a galaxy 90 light years away or 90 million light years away or whatever it might be, why does that affect me, or how does it affect me?
Yeah. So here's the big spoiler alert for the book, where the themes of the book is our universe is large, vast, cold, uncaring, unforgiving, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the big secret. What we've also learned over the past 400 years are the commonalities throughout the universe. We've learned that physics, our way of understanding how nature operates, doesn't just apply here on the Earth, doesn't just apply in the solar system, doesn't just apply in the galaxy, it applies throughout the universe. Physics is universal.
Gravity,
one of the four forces of nature, the exact same force that pulls an apple from a tree is the exact same force that keeps the planets in orbit around the sun. Exact same force. It's the exact same force that governs how a black hole works. It's the exact same force that governs the expansion of the entire universe. Exact same force.
Why is the expansion of the universe related to gravity?
So our understanding of...
My arms are spread out,
listeners.
Your
arms are stretching out like the expanding cosmos. Yes, it's beautiful analogy. Great radio. How we actually come to understand the history of the universe, how I can sit here and confidently say, yeah, the universe is 13.8 billion years old. How in the heck do you get a number like that? You get that through general relativity. General relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, is universally applicable. It can apply to motions in orbit around a star. It can apply to behaviors of galaxies moving around each other, and it can apply to the entire contents of the universe. You add up all the stuff in the universe, all the gas, all the dust, all the radiation, all the dark matter, whatever, you just add it up, and what the universe is made of governs its history. It governs its evolution. It governs how it changes with time. And we are able to make that relationship between contents and history because general relativity, those equations, are exactly what we need to make that connection. That theory is what we have to make that connection. So that doesn't just apply for general relativity. Electromagnetism, strong nuclear, thermodynamics, heat transfers, like all the physics of your everyday life, of our everyday lives, apply throughout the universe. It might be in some rather extreme scenarios and versions of it, but it's the same fundamental equations. It's the same fundamental math all across the universe. And that's the secret. We can actually learn about, say, nuclear power by studying our own sun or by studying the evolution of a distant galaxy. We can understand fundamental forces by watching how the universe unfolds before us. It's that connection that I think is much, much more powerful than the fact that our universe is cold and dark and uncaring and vast and all that.
How much are you curious about life on other planets? Whenever we hear, you know, every once in a while, there's news that life has been found or life might be found or something like that. And it turns out what they mean by life is some squiggly creature that doesn't have any discernible form. it's not what we think of as life, like lay people think of as life. So when you think of life as an astrophysicist, are you thinking of that squiggly thing that doesn't really apparently have any meaning to the rest of us? Or are you thinking about intelligent life?
I am all about the squiggly things.
Okay.
Oh, man. So we don't even have that. We don't even have. Oh, my gosh. If we were able to spot squiggly things on say, the InSight lander, which is going to land today, sends its probe a few feet under the ground, and there's squiggly things crawling around. Totally revolutionary. Nobel Prizes tossed around like candy. I mean, it would fundamentally alter our understanding of the cosmos. We don't understand fully how life arose on this planet. That is one of the big mysteries, and that is one of the questions we ask the night sky, right? Are we alone? And I talk about this briefly in the book, this idea of what are the chances? What are the fundamental chances of life arising on any one planet? Are we truly alone in the universe? And how can we even tackle that sort of question? So I talk about in the book, and I talk about the past couple decades, especially of our efforts to find planets outside of the solar system, of which we now know of a few thousand confirmed, and how we're tackling the problem, beginning to tackle the problem of, is there life somewhere else? We'll start there. And then go for the intelligent life thing that maybe we can talk to and share recipes with. But for now, we're just hunting for the squiggly bits.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Ohio State astrophysicist Paul Sutter. He has written a new book. It's called Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big Messy Existence. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So we have an email from Donna, who asks, where did the thing that exploded in the Big Bang come from?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. That's a great question. That's an excellent, excellent question, Donna, because the term Big Bang is one of the worst terms to ever appear in modern science and enter the public consciousness.
You think everything broke off gradually
It's tough. So I explore the earliest moments of our universe in this book, and I explore how we came to understand what we call the Big Bang, the evidence behind it in the history and the stories and wonderful, wonderful stories in the early 20th century. And the Big Bang was not a creation event. We do not understand the quote unquote creation of the universe. And that I start that off. That is chapter two. After I talk about Kepler and his wackiness, I start off, okay, let's talk about the Big Bang. The Big Bang, we don't understand the very earliest moments of the universe.
So we don't even know if it was a Big Bang.
We do know. There are some things we do know based on the evidence. We do know that 13.8 billion years ago, our entire observable universe, which is 90 billion light years across right now, was crammed into a ball about the size of a peach and had a temperature of over a quadrillion degrees. We have direct lines of evidence that tell us that that statement is correct. What happened before that, when the universe was even smaller and hotter and denser? That's a little bit harder for us to understand. We have some theories. We have some ideas. What happened? What about when the universe was less than a second old? When it was smaller than the size of an atom? We don't fully understand the physics there. We don't fully understand that kind of intensity.
How could you go from the size of a peach to the size of an atom?
Oh, so this is a wonderful, wonderful thing that we just learned about 100 years ago. We live in an expanding universe. Every day, our universe gets bigger than it was the day before. So if you run the clock backwards, the universe was smaller in the past. 5 billion years ago is smaller. 10 billion years ago is even smaller. Mm-hmm. 13 billion years ago is even smaller. And 13.8 billion years ago, it was down to the size of a peach. And then before that, and that's in the universe at that time was only like a couple seconds old. And if it was a second old, it's even smaller, a fraction of a second old, even smaller and smaller. It's talking a little baby universe. The Big Bang is our theory, our model of the history of the universe, not its creation. We don't understand the creation of the universe. We do understand its history.
Let's see. Mark in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning. Good morning. Stand out here in the cold. I'll try to be quick. my layman's understanding, listening to what you're saying, I'm fascinated with this idea of, you know, of the expanding universe and how it was infinitely small and the size of a peach or whatever. But is there a comparison? Is there a continuum, so to speak, in layman's mind? You can help me. I understand that atomic and subatomic particles are mostly held together just by forces and things that we consider solid, whether it be wood or steel or ourselves, aren't in fact solid. So am I thinking it all right that there's a continuum there of energy and energy fields and infinitely arranged particles, but be they mega or micro? I'm not saying it very well, but you follow my trend?
Oh, absolutely. I follow your trend. And that's also a wonderful question, asking about the scales. Like, is there a smallest possible thing? And is there a biggest possible thing? As far as we can tell, and, you know, this might change in a decade, so we'll just give, I'll give you the 2018 answer, which is there is a smallest possible thing. That the smallest subatomic particles, things with crazy names like electrons or quarks or neutrinos, are the smallest possible particles in the universe. There is nothing smaller than them. There is a fundamental limit to how small things can get. On the other end, on the big end, we have our universe. We have our observable universe that is 90 billion light years across. There's more universe out there. How big that is? Are there more universes that we are embedded in, something we call the multiverse? Maybe, maybe not. That's a lot fuzzier on the big end. The small end, we're pretty sure that there is the smallest possible thing. On the big end, we're not quite sure how big things get.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Okay, here's something that my education of science, my science education is rests primarily with science fiction, and I'm a big fan.
Same here.
So, okay. Oh, yeah. So, but some of it's ridiculous. And Men in Black is a good example. But there was that little universe.
Oh, the, yeah. Like we're just dangling from
the
collar.
Dangling,
yeah.
It's that pendant. Mm-hmm. And what is that emblematic of as far as our understanding of the universe? That little world.
Yeah.
It's a galaxy.
Yeah,
or something.
And I think this gets back a little bit to the last question of we see the limits of what we can see, 90 billion light years across. We know there's more stuff out there. Is the universe infinite or is it self-contained? Is it embedded in something larger? Are we just a mote in the eye of
God? That was the title of it.
Thanks for catching that reference. I was tossing that out to you. We don't know. We don't know. What we do know, is that we can completely and totally understand our universe just based on what's inside of it. So if you count up all the stuff, all in the arrangements of that stuff and how that stuff works, you can totally 100% describe the evolution of the universe, the history of the universe, and the future of the universe. You don't need the universe to be embedded in something larger, grander, in order to make sense of it. It's totally self-contained as far as we can tell. We don't know, but it doesn't need to be.
Steve and Marion, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you very much. Fascinating show. I had a question, but my question is more about space travel. And I guess I'm wondering, looking at it from the other direction, does anybody ever consider whether we should be traveling in space because of our really, really bad record here on Earth? I assume that we're polluting space very badly with all this junk on orbit up there, and I'm sure that the more better we become at traveling in space, we're going to take war to space. So my question is, with all the problems we have on Earth, starvation and war and all these things, that why is the priority not solving the problems on Earth and fixing these things technologically instead of spending, I don't know how much money is spent, but the millions and millions and possibly billions of dollars exploring space?
That's a very powerful question. I really appreciate that question. And I get that. I field that question a lot, not just in terms of space travel, you know, like this InSight lander going to Mars, private space development. Why should we bother doing that? To just fundamental cosmology, like, hey, these giant telescopes that we're using to unlock the mysteries of the universe aren't exactly cheap. You know, maybe we have wiser investments. And hey, Paul, you get a salary right at a public university. Is that the best use of our tax dollars? I hope so. I hope so. But here's the thing. Studying space, studying astronomy, traveling into space, putting space probes out there is not a priority. It's not a priority for us. A tiny sliver of a fraction of a percentage of the federal budget, state budget, private philanthropic budgets goes to science, goes to astronomy, and even less goes to space travel and space exploration. We honestly are not spending a lot of money. In absolute terms, yeah, we're spending millions and millions of dollars. But in terms of fractions of our GDP, it's pocket change. You could the country is digging through the couches to fund all of this knowledge. So what I'm saying, my argument is, I am such a bargain. I am only giving you complete knowledge of time and space for pennies on the dollar. And but it's an honest conversation we need to have, because we as scientists and explorers of space, explorers of the universe, we're working for you. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is because you own this knowledge. You own it. It is yours. You paid for it with your tax dollars. You deserve to know. You deserve to know how what we're understanding, how we understand it, why we understand it. You own that knowledge, and you deserve, as a taxpayer, you deserve that knowledge to be communicated to you in a way that you can understand, where you don't need two decades of training in the mathematics and the jargon to make sense of it, where it's accessible, understandable, appreciable. That's a word. But you own it. It's yours. So I thank you, everyone, for your contributions, tax dollars and otherwise.
But is it incumbent on scientists and people who are paid to do this work for us that they some people think they don't do a good enough job at explaining what the benefits are, and not just benefits in existential ways, but concrete benefits? There are a lot of, you know, I always think of this, you know, Velcro. Where would we be without Velcro? And that was something that was developed for space exploration.
We would not be attached, that's for sure. Right. We would be all over the place.
We'd be all over the place. I mean, so do we do a good enough job understanding the ancillary and, you know, these kind of these cast-off technologies that benefit us?
We don't.
I mean, if we hadn't have done that kind of exploration, would we have ever needed, or would we have known we needed, or developed it?
Yeah, you can get even more fundamental. So, no, to your question, no.
Space sticks, for instance.
I don't think
we're not worthwhile.
I don't think we're doing, as scientists, we're doing a good enough job explaining what we've learned, why it's useful, why it's important to the general public. One of the biggest examples I always cite is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is our physics understanding of the very small, of atoms and subatomic stuff. It was developed by a few dozen people in the early 20th century just for funsies, just math, pure theory, just trying to understand some experiments, you know, shooting electrons around like, oh, I wonder what's going on. Developing the math, quantum mechanics is now responsible for 25% of our modern GDP. Computers, synthetics, modern chemistry, nuclear power, all of that would be straight up impossible without our understanding of quantum mechanics, which was developed by theorists for theorists just for fun, just because they wanted to understand how the universe works. And then a century later, it's our modern lives are impossible without it.
We will continue our conversation with Paul Sutter. His new book is titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big, Messy Existence. We'll only be scratching the surface, but if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the universe as our home. Still with us is OSU astrophysicist and chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. His new book is titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big, Messy Existence. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What's the center of the universe?
Oh, the universe has no center. Isn't that weird? We live in an expanding universe, and yet it's not expanding from anything.
Yes.
Yes, it's weird.
The picture in the book makes it look like it's something, I don't know, like a dandelion that's being blown by the wind forward. Yeah.
But yeah, here's the thing. It looks like from our vantage point here on the Earth in the solar system in the Milky Way galaxy, it appears as if all galaxies are receding away from us, but you get the exact same picture from every other galaxy. Every galaxy, on average, is receding away from every other galaxy. The distance between galaxies grows.
So the distance between galaxies, but not the distance between the parts of those galaxies.
Exactly. The galaxies are gravitationally bound. They're glued together with gravity. So our solar system isn't expanding. Our galaxy isn't expanding. You have to go to cosmological distances. You have to go between galaxies before you notice this expansion of the universe.
So we better start figuring out what the other galaxies are doing, because we're going to someday be too far apart from each other to do it.
This is
kind of a pressure here.
This is the downer part of the book. Towards the end, I trace the history of the universe up to the present day, and then I look forward to the future. And we live in an expanding universe. Galaxies, on average, are receding away from us, which means there will be a time in the future where we will not be visible to any other galaxy. We will not see any other galaxy. And the formation of stars in our own galaxy is already winding down. We're already past the peak. We're not producing stars.
And we don't have any replacement bulbs.
We've got nothing. No. These are the old school incandescents. They don't manufacture them anymore. So once they burn out and they're like at the top, in the hallway, so you can't get up there. So you just forget it. I don't need to see in the hallway anymore. Our universe is dying. Our universe is dying right now. And it's only going to get darker.
Marion in Columbus, you're on the air with Paul Sutter. Hi, Marion.
Hi. Yeah, I'm Marion.
Yeah.
I have a question. I have a really, really hard time wrapping my head around the idea that you say the universe is expanding. Where is it expanding to? What is beyond the beginning? What is beyond the end? I can't grasp the idea of infinity. I mean, there's got to be a beginning and an end. There's got to be something else.
Okay. Hang on. Paul Sutter.
Oh, man, such a good question. And you're going to hate my answer because you can't wrap your head around it. You can't. And this is the most wonderful thing and also the most frustrating thing. We live in an expanding universe. There is no center. There is no edge. We live in an expanding universe. It is not expanding into anything. It simply does not exist. There is no such thing as outside of the universe, because if there was a thing outside, that'd be part of the universe too. It's kind of in the definition of the word universe. So there is no center, there is no edge, and yet we are expanding. And it is straight up impossible for our meat brains to comprehend that statement. But we have tools. We have tools that allow us to grapple with these concepts. We have tools that allow us to do things that our brains normally couldn't. We call these tools mathematics. Just like a hammer allows you to do things that you couldn't with a fist, or a saw lets you do things that you couldn't with the edge of your hand, mathematics allows us, and this is the big thing that we've realized over the past few hundred years, mathematics allows us to grapple with concepts that we can't fully put into words or wrap our minds around, but we can write down an equation to describe it, and we can use that to make predictions and testable observations and confirm that it's accurate. The mathematics allows us to understand a universe that has no center and no edge, and yet expands. And you're just going to have to live with it. Honestly, I can't understand it either.
Do we know that it's expanding in every direction, or is it all heading in the same direction?
It appears to be expanding uniformly in every single direction,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
There's no preferred direction. We check that, because that'd be really cool.
All right, Marian. I guess you'll just have to keep working at the wrap in your brain part. Let's see. We have an interesting email from Ryan. He asks, where does free will fit into the laws governing the universe and evolution?
Ooh, that's a deep question. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I'm a physicist. I'm an astrophysicist. And physicists look at the universe. We look at the world around us. We look at it through the lens of mathematics, because that's so powerful and so useful. Allows us to understand things we wouldn't normally be able to understand. And in physics, it's what we call deterministic. There's an initial condition. There are forces that govern that system, and then it evolves. And you can completely and totally predict what the end state would be given the initial state. So in that very restricted view, it appears that free will is not really a thing. It's an illusion. Like, it's all just physics and chemistry happening in our brains. And if I know how you're born and I can completely describe the state and I know the forces acting on you, I can completely predict your future. Where do we go from there? I honestly don't know. There's not really an answer there in terms of physics, because brains are really complicated. Our lives are really complicated. Maybe it's just one of these things that free will doesn't exist, but it looks like it exists. Maybe it does exist in some weird way that we don't fully understand. Maybe a mixture of the two. I don't have a good answer for you.
Email from Bob. Can Dr. Sutter discuss Planck length and Planck time? Are these the smallest possible divisions of length and time?
Yes. So when we look at the microscopic world, in the atomic world, in the subatomic world, in the subatomic world, and we keep going smaller and smaller, we find that when we start playing around with the fundamental constants of nature, things like the speed of light, things like the strength of gravity, things like the charge of the electron, we find that there's a certain length scale and time scale that we call the Planck length and the Planck time, because the Planck constant is involved. These are named after a physicist in the late 1800s named Max Planck, where things get really funky, where things are so small, distances are so small, time intervals are so short, that what we understand as physics kind of breaks down. We don't really know how to grapple with that. It could be that as the smallest possible division of space and time. And it's exactly at these scales where our understanding of the Big Bang breaks down. Once our universe gets smaller than the so-called Planck length, then we have no clue what's going on. Just because we have no clue what's going on doesn't mean that it's not still physical, that it couldn't be something. But this is an area that we currently fundamentally don't understand. And those are the Planck length and the Planck time are markers. They're signposts that are like, hey, if you want to understand stuff smaller than this, you need better physics.
Email from Joe. If the universe is a space-time continuum that began at some point, does it even make any sense to ask what came before it, since time began at that point?
Oh, yeah. And that's a wonderful question. And this gets to the heart of the Big Bang, how it's a description, a model of the history of our universe, but not its origins. We don't even know. We don't even know if it makes sense to talk about before the universe, as Joe, as you just mentioned. Because if time, quote unquote, started, then you can't have a thing before time, because you need time for there to be a before. It gets a little bit fuzzy. It gets a little bit weird. We don't even know if that question makes sense. We do not have a physical understanding of the earliest moments of the universe. Our ideas, things like space and time and gravity and forces and particles, simply don't apply to the very earliest moments of the universe. Someday we might be able to have a description, a physical description of that, and we can say, oh, yeah, our universe was seeded from something that came before, or, you know, blah, 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 blah. We don't have that yet.
The idea of your place in the universe and why it's important for us to feel like the universe is our home versus the earth keeps coming back to me. And I'm wondering, is there anything that we're learning about the earth that tells us more about the universe?
Oh, 100%.
So the more we understand how the earth works, okay.
Oh, 100%. It's this universality of physics that is the key
to everything.
So if you study how, say, a hot ball of gas operates on the Earth, then any place you see a hot ball of gas, you can understand the physics. And if that whole hot ball of gas is, say, the sun or another star or a nebula, you can apply the exact same knowledge. The laboratory experiments we do here on Earth, from tabletop demonstrations all the way to the most powerful colliders, atom smashers, apply throughout the universe. What we learn here is our knowledge. There's this amazing intersection between cosmology, the study of the entire universe, and fundamental physics, high energy physics, the study of the subatomic, the study of the tiniest things in the universe. There's this wonderful intersection because we're trying to answer the exact same questions.
You wrote about bad science reporting in an article on your website this month, which, by the way, we'll post a link to Paul Sutter's website so you can see all these articles and also find out where his book signings are and that kind of a thing coming up. But how – and I'm just not thinking about bad science reporting, but what about bad science fiction, that kind of a thing? How does that – how is that helping or hurting us, the lay people out there, as we move ahead?
Right. That's a really interesting question because I'm a fan of science fiction. When I watch science fiction or I read science fiction, I turn off my physics brain. You know, I assume, I don't try to apply this to the real world.
But that can't happen in the real world. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I don't try to play that game like, oh, they're going to jump through a wormhole. And I'm like, well, I know wormholes don't exist. But the book doesn't take place in our world. It's science fiction. It's not real. And I think bad science fiction, cheesy science fiction, taking outlandish ideas from physics, from our knowledge, from philosophy, playing with those ideas, grappling with those ideas, using them to drive a compelling story. That's all great. I think, though, there is sometimes a danger in taking science fiction and not knowing where the lines are between science fiction and science fact. Not knowing the lines between what we know based on centuries of evidence, what we speculate about, what are some interesting ideas to solve the challenges and problems that we face today, to stuff that is just outright wrong. Those lines are very blurry. I think they're blurred in the public consciousness. You don't always know if you just read a news article, you don't know, is this legit science? Is this someone making something up? Mm-hmm. I think that is far more damaging than something that is labeled and packaged and sold as science fiction. I am a writer doing creative things and making things up. Please enjoy the story. That's totally cool. But when it's And I encounter this a lot of, oh, I'm presenting things as science fact, but really I'm making things up. That's where things get a little dicey.
Paul Sutter, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul Sutter, astrophysicist at Ohio State University, chief scientist at COSI, and now the author of his first book. It's titled Your Place in the Universe, Understanding Our Big, Messy Existence. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.